Hello?
Hello?
Hey, Shagan. So, we are live. So, I just wanted to have a little chat with everyone smarter than me and see if we can't figure out a couple of details about blood pressure and mean systemic filling pressure. And since we'd had a little exchange about that PMSA, I just thought I'd get your view on it to start. So where do you think the PMSA sits? What can we do with it, et cetera?
Okay, so let's see. So the first thing I'll say is a big disclaimer. I love the idea of PMSA, but I don't actually use it practically.
Okay.
And the reason why I don't use it practically at the moment is because in the units I work in, the vast majority of people don't use it, and we don't have a device or a system that can actually measure or think in PMSA. So it's a bit like the Stewart acid-base approach. It's lovely and fantastic in principle, but if your blood gas machines all speak Henderson Hasselbalch and everybody around you understands Henderson Hasselbalch, that's a bit difficult to use in practice.
Understood.
So, and that said, the principle of PMSA, so PMSA is the closest thing I've found in literature and understanding that comes, that has, holds that concept of a filling state, or the filling state of the circulation at a particular point in time. And that idea I love, and if I could have a device or a system in place that could display PMSA, rather than the CVP or some other random number, I would love that.
Okay. Okay. How do you measure it currently?
So if I were to measure PMSA at the moment, I would actually directly calculate it using the Parkin formula.
Okay.
So his was 0.96 times CVP plus 0.04 times mean arterial pressure times C times cardiac output. So all of these things I can measure at the bedside using a mix of devices like the cardiography and I can estimate things. So I can technically estimate the PMSA for pretty much every patient that I see.
Okay.
What I do know about is there is actually a monitor called the Navicorder. I think it's by Philips, and that will actually plug in your MAP and your CVP and actually work out using the Parkin formula for you of PMSA.
Interesting. Okay. I guess the only thing for me about that is it's to me another one of these hemodynamic variables, much like in isolation, the CVP, the IVC alone, it gives you information, and I agree, but there's players that affect it. And I think I've said before about volume and things like that. I think we're asking a difficult question because let's say my, walking blood volume when I'm nice and healthy and reasonably well fed and all that is 5 liters. I go into septic shock or whatever kind of shock, and then you're trying to assess me. Your question is, to me, not so much what's this guy's volume status, but should I give him fluids or not, right?
Mm-hmm.
And my PMSA, just like my IVC, just like my right atrial pressure, my CVP will be affected, let's say, by the fact that I'm already on vasopressors, right? That I'll have increased my stress volume, increased my venous tone and all that. Because in the end, we really have the three things that we can use to act on is either fluids, vasopressors, or inotropes, right? And basically when we have shock, we're trying to decide between the three things, what should we do, right?
Absolutely.
And so I can reasonably look at you know, my cardiac function and say, you know, it's hyperdynamic, there's really no rationale imaginable to use inotropes, then I'm left with fluids or vasopressors to fix the deficient blood pressure. And so when I look, and I'm trying to distill this because I'm busy working on my my resuscitation pocketbook, and I want to plug in more concepts and I want to try to give recipes in there, and sort of to sort of track the intellectual process of going through shock. So when I'm down to deciding whether I should be giving fluids or more fluids or something, or should I just be hanging on tight with the vasopressors, I think it's a global assessment, which I think is a little complex, and, you know, there's part art in there. But I'm not sure how I would use that as a plus. Do you have any, can you tell me anything that would sort of say, okay, well, if I had a, you know, a PMSA of such and such, then I know I'd be going more for vasopressors or more for fluid.
So that's a really, really great question. And so the way I look at PMSA, and in particular, my interest in it kind of comes from that idea of the navicorder or having some kind of device or some way to routinely spit out a PMSA. And by extension, so if you look at the way the Parkin formula, you can work out a PMSA, then you can work out an index of cardiac work or cardiac power. And based on that, you can also work out an SVR. And these tools, for me, are targeted at the person at the bedside who may or may not have focus abilities. So, and who may or may not understand a lot of the complexities involved in hemodynamics, and they basically need a set of simple targets that they can aim for. So, for instance, so, you know, let's say, I'm sure you notice this as well, so you come to a patient, you've got a very complex patient in complex shock, there's aspects of hypovolemic shock, there's aspects of distributive shock, there's aspects of reduced cardiac power from sepsis-induced cardiomyopathy or whatever. And you do this complex assessment. You put in all these lines. And ultimately, what instructions are you going to give to the nurse at the bedside or your resident physician or junior physician at the bedside? You're going to say, give fluids or start this inotrope and call me in a couple of hours and I'll come back and reassess. Fair enough?
Yep.
However, if you have a tool like PMSA or a device that can spit out a PMSA, a cardiac work, and an SVR, and basically run that as continuous variables. And what you can then do, and this is where the navicorder is quite interesting, because the navicorder actually does this. You say to your staff, right, my numbers are in this red zone. I want you to give fluid until this number becomes green, and then I want you to give anotropes until this number becomes green, and then I want to give vasopressors until this number becomes green. And I appreciate that this is similar to the kind of thing that something like a PICO does, transforming thermal dilution, which has a bunch of red and green parameters for things like global end diastolic index and SVR and cardiac power. However, something like PICO has about 10 variables. This boils it down to 3. And 3 that are very simple to understand. And 3 that one just basically distills it down to the 3 things that you can do to manage a patient. And for me, I think that's quite attractive. Because I think it really simplifies it down for that person at the bedside in the middle of the night who may not understand POCUS or may not have a deep understanding of all the numbers you get from pulmonary artery catheter or something like that.
It sounds a little bit like the more automated versions of what we used to get with PA catheters, because I'm still a grad of the late 90s, early 2000s, and when I was a resident, I loved swan gansing everyone that had a pulse. And it was fun. You get a lot of numbers and you play with them. But ultimately, I think all those things don't address volume tolerance.
Yes,
and the problem is you're chasing numbers and maybe getting fluids and inotropes, but none of those parameters are looking at your skin modeling. Are you looking at the tension in your abdomen? Are looking at your FiO2 or your growing B lines in your lungs or anything like that? So it doesn't provide you with a stop point. So I think all that, which I think has been the push of a long time, like optimizing cardiac output, you know, to me is treating sepsis as if it was a cardiogenic / hypovolemic shock when it's not.
Sure.
And so it's like, let's maximize cardiac output. Like, there's one thing, maximizing stroke volume. Why on earth would we want to do that?
Absolutely, you are. You hit the nail on the head.
And so to me, that's the problem with all these things. They're fun to play with. I used to love playing with them, but you get the Michelin men and the quote-unquote ARDS. I told you, I don't really believe in ARDS anymore. It's all iatrogenic, or 99% as far as I'm concerned. And you get congestive renal failure and multi-system organ failure, and then we just say, well, the patient was so sick he died despite everything we did, or because of everything we did, partly.
Yeah, true.
So that's, to me, that's the only thing, is that if you're focused on volume, and can I give more to increase the cardiac output, but not paying attention to the side effects of it, essentially, I'm not sure if that's the right route to go down. But I agree with you, it can be useful for someone who doesn't have the rest of the armamentarium to get an idea, perhaps, of what's going on.
There is also one other advantage of PMSA.
Okay.
It's one of the few, it's not the only volume state parameter that recognizes the redistributed effects of vasopressors on stress volume.
Yes.
So if you titrate, if you start a noradrenaline infusion, your PMSA goes up.
Right. That's
so in many ways, So it probably represents the Guytonian model of the circulation, at least in my mind, much more closely than, you know, everything else, than your wedge pressure, than your CVP, than your IVC.
Yeah, sure.
And those kind of things.
Sure. I mean, the IVC is a reflection of the difference between your right atrial pressure and your PMSA.
Yeah.
Because, you know, the greater that difference, then the smaller your IVC is, and the closer they are, the bigger your IVC is.
Yeah, absolutely. And what you're saying is incredibly true. The IVC is not really a volume monitor. It's a dynamic cardiovascular state.
Absolutely.
And an incredible reflection of heart-lung interaction.
Yeah. I mean, that's what I say about all these variables. CVP, IVC, PMSA, none of them lie. You just have to ask them the right question. Make sure you're not asking them the wrong question. Cool. So, but good thought. I wonder if there's another use for it. Be on the flip side, is looking at, this is more the venous side, but is there over vasoconstriction? Because to me, that's going to bring me to my sort of second point that I want to quickly discuss, is that descending limb of the perfusion, pressure perfusion ratio. What do you think about that? Do you think, like, if you saw very high values of PMSA, you'd be like, well, maybe I'm a little over vasoconstricted. Maybe some of my venous constriction is acting as a resistor. Maybe on the arterial side, it might be contributing to the hypoperfusion. Any thoughts on that?
So that's a very good thought as well. So potentially, you could have patients in whom your PMSA is high. However, that your cardiovascular performance is low, and that, in theory, should be reflected by a low cardiac power performance and a very high SVR.
Yeah.
And in those patients, you would think about either dialing back your vasoconstrictors or adding some kind of vasodilating effect to them. So those may be people in whom you think about something like melanoma and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
And in
mm-hmm.
that particular in those particular patients, that's where I'm interested in the idea of investigating, essentially measuring ventricular arterial coupling.
Yeah, so, okay.
You've probably seen some of those papers where you can estimate VA coupling and uncoupling by measuring, doing some clever stuff with echo, measuring ejection time versus interventricular relaxation time and stuff like that. And you can estimate how close the VA coupling is. And so if you've got a very high PMSA with low cardiac function and an uncoupled and ventricular arterial uncoupling, that will potentially suggest that you're overconstricted.
Okay.
So that would be quite, I think there's a bunch of stuff there that would be quite interesting to look at and measure. I've been wanting to do this for some time, but for some strange reason, I've never actually got around to doing it.
All right. Well, when you do, let me know. the other thing that I was looking at, I was reading one of these hemodynamic reviews, and they were looking at, you know, what's the I came across this one graph by very bigwig ICU people, and showing basically sort of that autoregulation and what the blood flow relation to the blood pressure was, the perfusion to blood pressure. And my view doesn't quite sit with that. And especially not when that blood pressure in you know, a single septic patient is essentially being cranked up by dialing up the vasopressors. Clinically, what I've seen have noted in a number of cases that, like we were talking about over vasoconstriction, is that at some point when the blood pressure gets really quite high, but because of that arteriolar tone, your actual tissue perfusion goes down. To me, that's the patient that we see is very cold and mottled and all that. And their graph didn't reflect that. Their graph was just a sort of that order regulation kind of curve where, you know, it comes up first, flattens out, and if you keep cranking up the pressure, the perfusion keeps going up and up and up, and I don't think that makes much sense. Because to me, a lot of that, when we're looking at blood pressure, it's really the pressure in the arterial tree. And if we're cranking it up by squeezing on those arterioles, well, it may be going up on that end, but the pressure doesn't necessarily translate across the capillaries, where that's where the actual perfusion takes place. It doesn't really matter in a sense what the, you know, you just have to have driving pressure across into the capillary. So what do you think on that? That graph kind of bothered me when I look at that. I was like, I don't think that holds when you're looking at cranking up someone's blood pressure with vasopressors.
Those are incredible thoughts, because again, you're moving in a rather similar direction from me, except that you're moving even further. So you're moving away from ventricular arterial coupling to arterial capillary coupling. And making sure that, what you're basically suggesting, and this is something that I think we all know because we've all seen it in practice, if you try and suggest that the line between your vasopressor dose and your coupling, and that couples with your entire circulation in a linear fashion, you're only fooling yourself, because at some point, the relationship falls apart, which is why we see, you know, when you see people in whom you crank up the inotropes to rather silly levels, at some point they just go cold, muffled, and all their fingers and toes fall off.
Exactly.
And then they go into multi-organ failure. We all know that. And there are people in whom we've actually rescued them by providing vasodilator therapy when they've become really quite sick. So these are the patients in whom your noradrenaline is on a silly dose, and you add a small dose of some kind of vasodilating inotrope or whatever, and it just seems to do magic things to them. And their perfusion just kind of magically improves, and their cardiac function improves, and you look like you've literally resurrected Lazarus. So there is definitely an element there.
Yeah.
What you're saying.
Yeah, the other group of patients, like the ones you're talking about, is absolutely right. And the other ones is the group of patients that, and I don't know if you've come across that much yet, where I've inherited a few that have a radial art line and are on escalating doses of vasopressors, barely able to maintain, you know, a radial blood pressure, MAP of 60 or systolic of 90 or whatever, and are modeled blue, terrible lactate rising. Then you put in a femaline, and the actual blood pressure is 140. And then you wean off the HET levofed by two-thirds of it, and the perfusion is restored. So
yeah, absolutely. You put in the femoral arterial line, and the femoral arterial line trace basically looks like the Eiffel Tower.
Exactly.
Because they're just so squeezed.
Exactly. And it's much, I mean, for anyone listening who's not that familiar with that, the radial art lines, as far as I'm concerned, radial art lines are just for blood gas monitoring. They're not for shock monitoring. They often underestimate true blood pressure in shock states. So as soon as I have someone who's on anything more than a whiff of vasopressors, they get a femoral arterial line. And I mean, to me, that's the undeniable, you know, proof of concept that you have an inverted U-shaped type of relationship, or at least a descending limb of the perfusion blood pressure relation, and certainly not one that's linear, or, you know, at least in that upward axis as both values increase.
That's an interesting thought, and you're probably quite right on that.
Yeah, I think we need some capillary
Yeah, if you could kind of figure out a way to kind of measure coupling across the entire circulation. So you know when, so you need a way to couple your classical Starling relationship with, so couple your relationship with your left ventricle to your great arteries, couple your great arteries to your arterioles, and couple your arterioles to your capillaries, and make sure that everything's still running in series.
Mm-hmm.
And know the moment that you've done something to make one element of that fall out of whack. So either your capillary perfusion goes down, or your arterioles are too dilated or constricted, and then you can make steps to come back on each one to try and optimize the whole circulation. And all of these numbers are really just tools to try and do that.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Cool. That was very interesting. More thought, and we'll try and keep piecing it together.
Yeah, I think what I would love to do one day, I would love to find Jeffrey. He's in Australia. I need to find Jeffrey for him and get him to talk.
Sure. Yeah, you were saying that you want to get him on your podcast or speaker list. That would be very interesting. That would be very neat to do that.
Yeah. I think he has a bunch of really interesting thoughts, because my understanding is he was basically doing closed loop control of the circulation in the mid 90s, versus how he figured out all this stuff.
Fascinating stuff.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I think we'll close on that one. But there's going to be more. I think I'm going to speak to a whole other bunch of people and probably get back around to you again soon. And let's see what else we can come up with. Well, that's the fun thing about, you know, the exercise of, you know, whether it's writing books or handbooks or articles or anything, is that it kind of forces you through the mental exercise of being very thorough and kind of turning over every stone that you can find and et cetera.
Yeah, no, I agree. It makes us learn, makes us better.
All right. Thanks again, Shagan. Talk to you soon.
No worries, man. Anytime.
Ciao. Yeah.
Bye.